I'm about to talk with Eric Metaxas about his best-selling blockbuster new book on Martin Luther.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, many have been waiting now with great anticipation for the release of Eric Metaxas's new book on Martin Luther. And it is already a blockbuster book. It is a New York Times bestseller. It is getting amazing reviews like his Bonhoeffer book did. And I downloaded the book myself so I could have it on Kindle, even though we normally get a free hard copy from the publisher. I wanted to have it so I could read it for myself on my e-reader. And Eric has an incredible gift to do great research, but then to be a storyteller, and then to come with great spiritual insight. So we're going to have a great talk with Eric. We're going to unfold Martin Luther. I think you're going to learn things. I am prepared to learn things that I didn't know before. One interesting thing, I wrote an article, posted yesterday, on what Martin Luther and Donald Trump have in common. And I just shot a note to Eric, hey, FYI, you might be interested in this. And he wrote back immediately and said, I was writing an article with the exact same title. He was working on one. He didn't get to finish it, though. But he was working on an article with the exact same title. Now, I knew that with his book just coming out in time for the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, I knew that his schedule would be totally slammed. So I didn't even want to ask him to come on the air until it cleared. But it so happened that he had this slot open. So glad to bring Eric on. I get to interview the master interviewer. Not only is he a New York Times best-selling author, he's also host of the nationally syndicated radio show, The Eric Metaxas Show, and leads the Socrates in the City meetings in New York City. He's done that for many years. Hey, Eric, welcome to my broadcast this time. Great to have you on.
Oh, man. Mike, what an honor. I've loved you and observed you and listened to you for years, and it's just great to call you friend. And great to talk to you about important stuff, whether it's on my program or on your program.
Yeah, well, it's my honor entirely to have you on. Hey, Eric, are you surprised by the supernatural favor that's been on your writings? I know you're a humble guy. I know you work really hard at these books. But are you surprised to see how God's used them?
Well, it's a funny thing. It's a combination of it's not really that I'm surprised, but neither do I take it for granted. I think that the feeling that I feel is gratitude. I feel profound gratitude to the Lord because for many years I was not really successful. I was really struggling as a writer, trying to get my name out there, trying to, you know, do all kinds of things, and it wasn't really working well. I mean, I wasn't dying, but I was really struggling, and so when the Bonhoeffer book hit the way it did, I was just flooded with gratitude to God because it really had been a hard, long haul. So anytime I go on the road and I meet people and they say that they have read my books or my books have affected them or even they listen to the radio show, and it means so much to me. It just thrills me. So I'm just grateful to God that, you know, I want him to use me. And as he is using me, I'm full of joy and gratitude. There's no doubt about it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm thrilled, Eric, that he's using you. I was just telling the Lord earlier how thrilled I am to see the success on your books, but not just the success, the impact that they're having. All right, this was just to whet your appetite. We'll be right back, and we're going to dive in to Eric Metaxas's blockbuster new book on Martin Luther. Why did this man effectively change the Western world? Change the world. Change the world.
is The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My guest is Eric Metaxas. His brand new book on Martin Luther, the man who rediscovered God and changed the world. Eric, we know all too well that there's a massive amount of literature on Martin Luther. He's one of the most studied characters of the last 500 years. Why did you feel it was important to write a new biography of Martin Luther? All right, it looks like something just happened there, and we lost Eric. He didn't drop. It's not that he's afraid to answer the question, but somehow with both of us doing daily radio shows, in fact, his second hour is on. It's obviously a pre-recorded hour, so he's in two places at once right now. But somehow, the call dropped out. We are reconnecting with Eric right now. He did not get intimidated by my question, but we're reconnecting now. Two radio hosts having a hard time connecting. But something very interesting is that most of us who are followers of Jesus think of Martin Luther primarily in religious terms. In other words, the Protestant Reformation, the break between Protestantism and Catholicism, right? We think of those things. Or we think about Luther's translation of the Bible and getting the Bible out to people in conjunction with the printing press or things like that. But the impact and influence of Luther was far beyond that. And Eric lays that out, the introduction to his book. He refers to Luther as pastor, rebel, prophet, and monk. And what's really fascinating is he tells a story here about a Baptist pastor, 1934, African-American Baptist pastor who traveled over to Germany, was at an international conference on Baptist pastors. His name was Michael King. He had a five-year-old son named Michael King Jr. This black pastor was so moved by what he heard about Martin Luther, he changed his name to Martin Luther King and the name of his son to Martin Luther King Jr. The impact of Martin Luther is larger than we might realize. So, Eric, before we were so rudely interrupted, my question was this. You know, having done the research, that there's a massive amount of literature on Luther. Why did you feel the need to tell the story afresh and to do fresh research?
Well, that's a good question. I guess the answer is twofold. First of all, I was convinced by my friend, to whom I dedicate the book, by the way, Marcus Speaker and my friend Greg Thornberry, the president of the King's College here in New York City, they convinced me that because it was the 500th anniversary, that I needed to write a new biography. They were saying that, you know, the famous one written by Roland Bainton came out like 70 years ago. And you think, 70, is it really that long? It's that long. It's like 1950. And that's the one that they use typically. And they were saying that really it's such a fascinating story. And as I looked into it, I discovered that, yes, first of all, his life is so influential, it's shocking. When you realize what came into the world as a result of his faith and courage, it's stunning. And I didn't know it, and I'm always embarrassed when I learn things. Like, I think, how did I not know this? And then I get a passion to tell everybody that I could. But the other side of it, Mike, is that it's a very entertaining story. It's very funny and crazy, and he's a larger-than-life character. And I thought it would be nice after writing Bonhoeffer, which was, you know, kind of a tough story. It's a hard story. It's like watching Schindler's List. You don't do it for fun. It's kind of, it's important, it can be inspiring, but it's not entertaining. This is an entertaining story. And I thought, I want people to have something fun to read. It's meaningful, it's important, but it's also fun. It's a crazy story. I included all kinds of tidbits that I, you know, discovered. I thought, this stuff is hilarious. I mean, some of it is just really funny. And I thought, it's nice to enjoy reading a book. It doesn't always have to be necessarily all serious.
Yeah, and Luther is certainly one of the most controversial and unusual figures, and in a certain way, one of the most unlikely figures. And you mentioned in your book that the story didn't necessarily have to happen. In other words, it's not that Luther started out with this vision of, I am going to be the great reformer, and I'm going to take on the Catholic Church and even the culture and the mindset of the day. So give us just the brief overview of his history and how it ends up that he becomes this giant figure in world history.
Well, you're right, and that's one of the things that surprised me too, because I think even yesterday I was on a Catholic radio program, and they say, well, I have heard this and I have heard that, and you think, honestly, there's a lot that people have heard about Luther that is simply not true when you look at the facts. And one of those things is the idea that he wanted to break away from Rome, that he wanted to start this Protestant church. That's simply not true. He didn't. He was a faithful son of the church who was trying, in a humble way, through the proper channels, he was trying to effect some change, but it wasn't the kind of change that he ended up affecting. He noticed some problems, and he thought, we need to talk about this. So, just to give people the background, he never wanted to become a monk. His father was a successful businessman in the mining business, and people always say Luther was poor. He was not poor. There's a whole bunch of things that I discovered that you hear over and over and over. They're not true. In fact, I was speaking at a church recently, and my wife said, while you were speaking, they had these things, facts about Luther on the big screen, or, you know, on the left and the right. And she said one of them was this whole thing about Luther being poor. And in my talk, I made it clear, like, that's not true. He was not poor. His father was a successful businessman in the mining business, and he wanted his son to help him in the business. And so he wanted this genius of a son to go to fine schools, to go to the university, which the parents did not. They were not able to study in the university. But he was able, he was brilliant, to go to the university, to study law, and then to come back home to Mansfeld to help his father in the family business. But something strange happened. Luther, there's always this story that it was a lightning storm that forced him to become a monk. He got scared, and he blurts out a vow to St. Anne, if you save me, I'll become a monk. Well, that's not exactly how it happened. All of that did happen, but what preceded it was obviously His real thinking over the years about God, about salvation, about hell. He became more and more convinced that he cannot go and study law, that there was a call on his life, that somehow he needs to become a monk. That was not something that popped into his head one day in 1505 while he encounters this thunderstorm. You know, it was July 1505 that he's returning back to the university to study the law, and he's in a thunderstorm, and that's the moment that he makes this vow to St. Anne, who is the patron saint of miners. He just blurts out to her, if you save me, I'll become a monk. He was sure that he's going to step into hell. He's going to go into eternity, and it's over, and he's horrified, so he blurts this out. When he doesn't die, he decides, okay, I am going to enter the monastery. Now I've made a vow, I'm going to do it. So he enters the monastery, and now starts this endless, torturous process of trying to climb the ladder to God, trying to pray hard and trying to fast till he's skin and bones and do all these things to get closer to God, to earn his way to heaven. And we know people who do this kind of thing in the evangelical world.
Yeah,
they just
sure.
think that somehow I got to do this and I got to do this again. And it can become about what you're doing as opposed to about God's grace. And we have to be very careful. So Luther gets stuck in this mode of, I'm praying, I got to pray harder, I got to do this, I got to do that. He never felt the peace of God. He never felt the joy of God. It was always about God as a grim judge. And again, there are many Christians today in the Protestant world who have that view of God. They're kind of like, well, I fear God. Well, do you have awe of him? Do you love him? Do you know that he loves you? Or do you just kind of think like, he's somebody I got to jump through hoops, otherwise he wants to cast me into hell? Well, Luther had that view, and he's lacking peace, and this goes on and on and on, and his confessor, von Staupitz, one of the characters in this book, who's a real, just a great man, you could see that he was really like a father figure to Luther, trying to help him in his relationship with God, and he's saying to Luther, what's the matter with you? You act like you hate God, or you act like God hates you. God loves you. But Luther didn't get it, so he finally starts to dig into the scriptures. Now, we all say, oh, great, of course. Well, no, nobody was digging into the scriptures. There were no Bibles. I mean, imagine, printing had just been invented, so everything was written on scrolls. You can imagine how expensive it was. Nobody had the ability to study the Bible. So it's kind of a rare thing that he starts to study the Bible, and he slowly but surely becomes more and more familiar with it until one day around 1517, he reads in Romans, the just shall live by faith. It hits him like a ton of bricks, that it is faith in what God has done that reconciles you to God. It is not what you do. It is not works. It is not your prayers. It is simple faith that Jesus has already done everything that needs doing, and that by faith you are reconciled to God.
When
that
happens, just to jump in, because we have a break here. We who grew up in the Lord with that don't realize how staggering that revelation was. We'll be right back with Eric Metaxas.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to the Line of Fire. I'm speaking with New York Times bestselling author and radio host, Eric Metaxas. If you don't have his new book on Martin Luther, get it. You'll be interested from the opening pages. You'll be drawn in. Eric is a master storyteller, but he does great research to back up what he is talking about and paints an incredible picture along the way. So Eric is telling us the story of Luther, who reading Romans somewhere in 1517, the light goes on. This is a shocker. Being justified by faith, it was a shocker in the culture and the church of the day. And Eric, I don't know that we have anything equivalent today that compares to what Luther was dealing with in terms of the influence of the Catholic Church, the way the culture looked at things, the way the leadership, there was just a corporate mentality versus the individual mentality. Can you give us some feel of how radical it would be to think that you've got something new that everybody else doesn't see?
Well, I think that there are people that walk around crippled with fear of hell, because they think they've got to do something, and they don't know what to do. They keep thinking that somehow they're guilty, guilty, guilty. And the thing is, like, yes, you are, but all you need to do is put your trust in Jesus. He died to save you from hell. He died. You know, it's something that some people feel like, but I don't deserve it. I don't deserve it. And they keep somehow thinking, I've got to do something. And if you really care about your salvation, that will torture you. Now, God loves us, and he doesn't want us to be tortured. He wants us to be comforted that he has done everything that's necessary. Luther lived at a time where nobody really believed that. People really believed that I don't deserve hell. I don't deserve heaven, and I don't know what's going to happen to me, but it doesn't look good. Luther was really tortured by this. So when he reads in the scriptures that it is his faith, that it's only faith that saves us, all we have to do is believe, it just revolutionized everything for him. He could not get his head around it. And so this comes at the same time that he had decided that he needs to call for an academic debate on this thing called indulgences. The two are sort of related, but not really. Indulgences is what kicked everything off, and people said, people knew that the practice of indulgences was corrupt. It's basically where you give money to the church and you kind of get a certificate, and that, you know, it's like a free ticket out of purgatory or a free ticket out of hell or whatever it is. And Luther could see, as a priest, this is corrupting the souls of the faithful. They're coming to him in confession with these certificates that they paid for. He says, this is not right. This is corrupting them and making them cynical about God and about the church, and we need to do something about it. So he famously, exactly 500 years ago, nails 95 theses. These are nothing but debate points. He nails it to the door, which was the local church, and it was really the local bulletin board. But he nails this this document. And what was the document? All it was. There's a lot of stuff in my book where I get to the point where I see what it really was. People always act as though when he nailed those that document to the door, he was like sticking his finger in the Pope's eye and saying, this is true and we need to deal with this. It really isn't true. He was a humble man of God trying to invite people to have an academic debate.
And he posted in Latin. He posted this in Latin.
He posted it in Latin. Right. So it was not for everybody to read. It was just for his fellow academics and for the elites. And the whole point of it was not to get a conversation going. It was to have an academic debate. The theologians, the professionals will have a conversation. And then it will work its way up, and maybe the church will begin dealing with something it needs to deal with. He never wanted to start a big raging controversy. He would have been horrified at the idea. And so he puts up this notice on the door of the church. And people say, well, we put it on the door of the church. That's really sticking it in the Pope's eye. Well, here's the issue. The local bulletin board was the church door. If you were missing a cat, you would put the notice on that bulletin board. So he puts it up there. And long story short, all hell breaks loose. He becomes attacked. It turns into this gigantic argument. And as the argument goes on and on and on, Luther gets drawn out more and more to say other things, many of them having to do with what we just discussed, this issue of grace versus works. And it gets more and more out in the open. And eventually, the church excommunicates him, and he kind of is out on his own. And it really was as a result of the church behaving in a way that was not appropriate. In other words, that Luther was hoping that they're going to give him a fair hearing and that they'll say, by the way, thank you very much. We needed this to hear about these things. We're going to deal with it. Instead, they basically said to him, you need to shut up. You're trouble. And it's a sad thing because, to get back to your initial question, it didn't need to go this way. The Reformation did not need to happen this way. It's caused all kinds of division. It's sort of it is a pity, but it really is because the church hierarchy was unable to hear his criticism. It just got ugly real quick, and it got out of hand, and next thing you know, you're never going to get the two people back to the bargaining table.
All right, we've just got about a minute and a half before the break here, but what was it, in your view, as you look at Luther, being an academic, being a reluctant figure to lead this new movement, what is it that gave him the courage to stand when he was basically told to stand down by every authority figure that he would have looked to, be it secular or religious, stand down? Right. What is it that caused him to stand?
I think it's pretty simple, Mike. I think it's simply this. He knew that what God thought was far more important than what people thought. In other words, he thought, even if they kill me, which they were going to do, he says, I don't care. I've got to speak the truth. God will hold me responsible if I just tell them what they want to hear to save my life. I've got to speak the truth. God will back me up. It's an amazing moment in the history of the world because he could have just said, listen, I was a little hasty. Yeah. I'm sorry. I recant everything. And he could have walked out of there. But he couldn't do it. And he wasn't like proud, like beating his chest. He was humbly before God saying, I care what God thinks of what I say. And I fear God more than I fear man. Now, he lived it. He was going to be killed. But he says, I really trust God. We need to get to a place where we trust God that much and know that God wants us to speak the truth. I mean, it's an amazing thing to see this hero of the faith live out his faith, face down death and all kinds of stuff, but he was willing to do it. And I have to say, it's an inspiration.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is, as often happens with a reforming type of movement, that the more you begin to recognize their problems, it's like peeling an onion. And then the breach, the differences with the Catholic Church of the day, they become deeper and deeper and deeper. The divide becomes deeper and the differences become deeper. When we come back, I want to talk about changes that Martin Luther made on the world, even beyond the religious debate. And then what about the blemishes? What about the faults and flaws of this world changer, Martin Luther? All that when we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Who is the man who rediscovered God and changed the world? Well, that would be Martin Luther. Who is the man that has written now a new definitive biography of Martin Luther? That would be Eric Metaxas, my guest right now on the Line of Fire. Eric, you not only speak of Luther and God, you speak of Luther and the world. In what ways, the most fundamental, wide-ranging ways, did Luther literally change the Western world?
Well, that's another one of these questions where when I realized this, I couldn't believe it, that let's follow the dots, because we say Luther, but it's really the gospel of Jesus. But the point is that Luther brings the gospel of Jesus Christ into history in a new way. For example, if you preach that we are all equal in God's sight and that we're all responsible before God equally, right? That means that if some religious leader is telling me something that's not true, I have a responsibility before God to stick to the truth, not to what the guy's telling me. Mm. Luther finds himself in the position where he says, I'm being told one thing, but I know, according to the Word of God, according to the Bible, that that's wrong. I've got to stick with what I know is true. Once you do that, you're sending a message to everybody that we are all equal in God's eyes. Just because somebody has authority over you, whether spiritual authority or governmental authority, you've got to understand God is over both of you. Once you understand that God is over both of you, you hold that authority figure accountable. You don't say that authority figure is like God. They determine right and wrong and truth. No, you have to buy into what is right and wrong. And if you don't, you know, you may want to go to a different church. You may want to speak up against what is happening. The moment that happens in history, it's almost like the whole world was North Korea. You have a state and a church that are determining what is true. And then suddenly people come up and they say, wait a second, I think that there's some problems here. The moment that idea that the individual could speak truth to power, the whole world changed. Suddenly you get diversity, right? You have Protestant areas and Catholic areas. Now you have, it's like the free market of ideas. Who do you agree with?
So individualism.
Right, the Protestants, right?
Individualism
comes out. I mean, a lot of bad stuff can come out of it.
Course,
relativism
of course.
And subjective views of truth. So we know everybody's got a view of the Bible or whatever now that nobody listens to anybody. But the point is that when you have freedom, you have the right to be wrong. You have the right to be right. Now you have true freedom. In those days, everybody was told, this is what you must believe. It led to American-style self-government. It led to liberty. It led to religious liberty. Everything that we have in the modern world, for good and for ill, came from Martin Luther bringing the gospel of Jesus Christ into history in a way that for 15 centuries it had not been in history. And it just gives us everything. It's an amazing, amazing moment, and it happened exactly 500 years ago yesterday that this whole thing was kicked off. And again, that's why I wrote the book. This is the 500th anniversary, so it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, and we just got 40 seconds before the break, but you had a deadline on this one when your friend suggested that you should write, and then it was suggested you should get it out before this time. Did you like the deadline or no?
I always do, Mike. I work better with a deadline because
yeah,
I think
here.
That a book like this, there's so much. You could work for years and years and years and
exactly.
never end it. So the fact that I had to get the book done by a certain time, it focuses you. And I think, but I'm very, very happy the way it turned out because I did find some new things. When we come back, I'll tell you one thing I discovered that no one ever wrote about before. And it is mind-blowing. If you read the book, you know about it, but I would love to tell the audience because it's just no one's ever mentioned it before.
Well, tell you what, I've only started reading the book. I haven't finished it yet, so I'm going to find out. I am not going anywhere, all right? I'm going to be right back with Eric, and then we'll take a few minutes to talk about how could God use a man that was so flawed? Eric Metaxas, the book, Martin Luther.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. We'll have our entire interview with Eric Metaxas online for you later to listen to. Just go to AskDrBrown.org to connect with us in all different points. If you don't have the book yet, get it. Martin Luther, the man who rediscovered God and changed the world. If you're unsure about getting it, just look at the reviews of the book from scholars, from media folks like Hugh Hewitt and others. I was thrilled. I was thanking God for the scholarship behind this book, for the work Eric put in, and for the impact that it's certainly going to have. All right, Eric, you're going to tell us something that most of us have never known before about Martin Luther. We're all ears.
I don't think, unless you've read my book, I've never read this anywhere, and I read a ton of books on Luther. But when I did the research for my book, and you'll get this because you believe that the Holy Spirit can lead us at times, and I have to say, I started writing the book, and the first thing I bumped into was the fact that we don't know what year he was born. Nobody can prove that he was born in 1483. That seems most likely, but it could be 1484, could be 1482. We actually don't know. But he was born on November 10th, so let's say it was 1483.
Yep,
he's born on November 10th, and the next day he is taken to a church 100 yards from the house and baptized because they feared that if a child dies without being baptized, he will go to hell forever. Imagine living with that kind of fear, right?
Yeah.
So he's baptized, and what day is November 11th? Oh, it's St. Martin's Day. That's the feast day of St. Martin in the Catholic Church, so they name him Martin. All right, now let's move on with the story. But I actually felt, Mike, the Holy Spirit must have been nudging me. I didn't know at the time it was the Holy Spirit, but it was a weird nudging, like, look into St. Martin. And I kind of thought, oh, well, why? I mean, if his name was Barney, if his name was Fred, like, why does his name... But it's almost like I had a sense that there's something prophetic in his name. So I thought, well, let me look at it. And by the way, I love to teach my reader. You know, if you're reading the book, you're going to learn a lot of stuff. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to learn, who is St. Martin? Who is he named after? So Martin Luther was named after St. Martin. I look it up. St. Martin lived in the early 400s. He was a Roman citizen. He became a serious Christian early in life against his parents' wishes. So he becomes a devout Christian, and he's enlisted in the Roman army, but they didn't see any battles. They were just kind of keeping the peace or whatever. But at some point, in a place called Borba Tomagos, he's called to fight. And he refuses to fight. He says, "I, in my stand for Christ, I will not kill. I'll go into the battle, but I will not kill." So it's a big thing, and you know, he is really facing death, because if you say to the Roman army in the 420, whatever year it was, that I'm not going to fight, you know, that you're standing up against the emperor. How dare you? But he takes a stand for Christ, and he lives, and then he becomes a monk. And his most famous moment in his life is this stand he took in this place called Borba Tomagos for Christ, against the emperor, against the Roman, you know, it's a big thing. So I look at it, it's like, oh, that's interesting. And then I realize that there's a weird parallel, because you have Martin Luther, his most famous moment, it's not nailing the 95 Theses, it's what happened 4 years later. 4 years later in 1521 is what we call the Diet of Worms, the famous Diet of Worms, the ugly name. There's a German city called Worms, we pronounce it Worms, but in the city of Worms, they had a conference of all of the leaders in the empire, every prince, every duke, every archbishop. They all gathered once a year at a congress, right? And they called it a diet. That's just a weird Latin word. So it's the Diet of Worms. And it was at that place that Luther takes his stand for Christ, faces death, and lives. And it's his most famous moment. It's the moment he said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." So it's his moment that when you look at the life of Luther, that is the moment where he takes his stand for Christ, faces death, and lives and becomes famous as a Christian. Okay, so I thought, what a curious parallel. Martin of Tours in 400-something and Luther in 1521, 11 centuries later, had a very similar experience. One is standing in front of the Holy Roman Emperor. The other one is standing in front of the Roman Empire. And then this is where my jaw dropped. Luther took his stand in the place we call Worms, Germany. Has anybody ever heard of Worms, Germany for any other reason that Luther took his stand there? It's not like a major city. It's not like London or Paris. It is Worms, Germany. Okay. So it happens in Worms, Germany. So I look up Martin of Tours, 1,100 years earlier, took his stand in a place called Borbotamagos. Where the heck is Borbotamagos? I look it up. It says modern day Worms, Germany.
That's crazy.
Is that not? That's nothing but a miracle. I mean, if anybody is not blown away, you mean that God prophetically spoke into history in such a way that it took until the 21st century that anybody noticed this? I've never heard anyone say this. I've read all this stuff on Luther. I discovered this. My jaw dropped. I said, God spoke into history. He ordained this, that this man would be born on a certain date, named after someone 11 centuries earlier who happened to take his stand for Christ that made him famous in the same place that Martin Luther, 30-something years in the future, would happen to take his stand. It is so crazy.
It is.
But that was God's way of communicating to me as an author to say, Eric, I'm in this. This is important. And that just blew my mind. I'm the first person that I know of that ever noticed this or told that story.
That's wild.
But it puts a holy mark on this man's life.
Yeah, and then even the story you tell right at the outset of the book of Mike, African-American Baptist pastor Michael King, changing his name to Martin Luther and changing his five-year-old son's name to Martin Luther King Jr. So, I mean, the marking of the name and the person, extraordinary. All right, so here's of course, the quandary that we have with all this.
Oh, yeah.
Is that Martin Luther was a wrecking ball type of person, that his writings would make the worst of Donald Trump's tweets sound tame. And I think you and Dennis Prager, someone told me you compared Trump is like Trump to Pence.
Yes, I said Luther makes Donald Trump look like Mike Pence.
Right, exactly. So, and of course, my special intersection with Luther is his writings about the Jews, which you devote a section in your book to, horrific writings, but not just about the Jews, about others, that you cringe. And then some of his writings that when they would translate them from German, they would leave some things in Latin and put them in Latin because they didn't want the profanity. So how is it? I mean, if a guy was that mightily used by God, and yet on the other hand was that carnal, was just towards the end of his life? Was he sick?
Well,
was it all of his life? How do you explain it?
I don't really explain it, but what I do is I try to put it in context so that you can understand it better.
Okay.
I mean, there are people, and in this culture, there are people that they're in love with finding the worm in the apple. They're in love with finding, like, aha, he said this about the Jews, therefore we can ignore everything he ever said. And you think, wait a second. If somebody says 1 plus 1 equals 2, it doesn't matter what he thinks about the Jews. 1 plus 1 equals 2 happens to be correct. So Luther said a lot of correct stuff, but at the end of his life, I mean, there's many things to take into account. First of all, you can't make what he said anything other than vile. I mean, he said vile things about the Jews, but to put it in context, he said incredibly vile things about everybody he disagreed with. He said equally vile things about the Pope and the Catholics. In fact, worse things about the Pope and the Catholics. He said horrible things about Islam, about the Turks. He said horrible things about his fellow Protestants with whom he disagreed. He was vicious. So he said vicious things about everybody. Now, why do we care about what he said about the Jews? Because of a thing called the Holocaust. And because who was it who tells us, oh, look what Luther said about the Jews? It was Goebbels. The Nazis said, aha, look what we found that Luther wrote. We can use this to make the average German think that their hero Luther agreed with us. Now, by the way, Luther did not agree with the Nazis. Whatever he wrote about the Jews is not equivalent to the Nazi view that if you are racially Jewish, you're subhuman. Luther never said any of that, and he wrote a lot of positive stuff about the Jews that, of course, the Nazis would never, ever quote.
Sure.
So you have to understand that it was Goebbels and the Nazis very cynically finding this thin pamphlet that Luther wrote on the Jews at the end of his life when he was very cranky and sick and saying nasty things about everybody. When you put it all in context, it's not nearly as bad as people portray. it doesn't make it wonderful. When you read it, it's embarrassing. But
right.
the other thing that's important to understand is he didn't believe in religious liberty, even though what he did brought religious liberty into the world. Luther himself was living at a time when whatever your territory was, that's what you were. In other words, he fought for the ability to be Protestant, but he didn't fight for the ability that everybody can believe what they want. So that you now had a situation where Catholics are killing Protestants, Protestants are killing Catholics, and then in Saxony, which was Protestant and Luther was living there, they thought, and the Jews, by the way, let's get them out of Saxony so we can just be a Protestant state. Now, in our day, we go, that's vile. We should agree to disagree. We can let Muslims and everybody be here. But in those days, they didn't think that way. So it's kind of complicated.
All right. And Eric, with that, we are out of time. I know you got another interview to run to. But thanks for whetting our appetites. God bless you, man.
God bless you. Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So on my Kindle e-reader, I'm holding Eric's book and hundreds of other books, and he has a whole section on Luther and the Jews. I put out a very strong statement yesterday about Luther's writings concerning the Jews, just basically saying, okay, here they are. I want you to hear them for yourself and feel the weight and gravity of them. And of course, as I said in the video, if you haven't watched it, just go to AskDrBrown.org and look at our digital library. If you haven't watched it, I mentioned there clearly that, Luther had earlier written in 1523, 20 years earlier, a gracious book reaching out to Jewish people. And so in Eric's book, he has a whole section on Luther and the Jews. And he said, without question, one of the most bizarre episodes of Luther's life concerns his writings at the very end of his life on the subject of the Jews. No scholar in five centuries has been able to make sense of the worst of what he said, mainly because it flatly contradicts much of what he had written on the subject earlier in his life. In fact, earlier in life, Luther hoped that the Reformation would help many of the European Jews see that the Christians who had so mistreated and reviled them were not actual Christians at all, but were merely Gentile hypocrites. In 1519, he wondered why Jews would ever consider converting to the Christian faith, given the cruelty and enmity we wreak. we wreak on them. That is our behavior towards them. Let me clear my throat here. All right, there we go. That's better. Push the magic button and clear the throat at the same time. So all that to say, Eric wrestles with the issues in his book, and on the air now was trying to put things in larger context regarding Luther. My point in raising these issues about Luther is to recognize what happens when a wrong theology gets turned loose. Because again, for centuries, Lutherans either ignored his negative writings on the Jews and espoused his earlier writings, reaching out graciously and honoring the Jewish people, or they actually repudiated. Several times in history, this is long before the Holocaust, Lutheran leaders repudiated his other writings concerning the Jews and their lies, other ugly writings about the Jews. But the big offshoot of all of this is, one, the danger of wrong theology, and two, God using a very flawed human being, and yet God using him greatly. My understanding, my takeaway from this, as I look at my own life, and our lives, each of us individually, and as I look at, say, President Trump as an example of this, and remember that President Trump, in terms of being volatile, in terms of being controversial, in terms of writing things that upset people, is as Eric said, is like Mike Pence when you compare Luther to Trump. So Luther to Trump is like Trump to Mike Pence, and that paints a pretty vivid picture, I would say. So what I look at is that God used his strengths, but the flip side of his strengths, the same bull in a china shop, take on the world, can't back down mentality, right, that we see with our president as well, if not channeled, if not softened, I'm talking about the flip side of it, then you can end up hurting people rather than helping them. As I've said, sometimes you need a wrecking ball, sometimes you need a sledgehammer, Sometimes you need a scalpel, right? And depends on what you're doing. You don't do surgery with a sledgehammer. You don't break a building down with a scalpel. And that's why for any of us with strong personalities or strong calling, don't use that as an excuse for your flaws or weaknesses, all right? I'm saying that to me because that speaks to me directly. Don't point to, well, God just made me to do that. There's never an excuse for sinful behavior. And we see, regrettably, some of the legacy of Luther and why many Catholics reject Luther, not just his theology, but his behavior. At the same time, he was mightily used by God. At the same time, he had an extraordinary impact on history. At the same time, in many positive ways, we wouldn't be here today if not for Martin Luther. All right, friends, one quick announcement, and then I just want to comment on the terrorist attack in New York City yesterday. Our GoFundMe page, if you've never visited there, please take a moment and go to GoFundMe.com/AskDrBrownStudio. That's GoFundMe.com/AskDrBrownStudio. There's a short video you can watch there. We'll give you an overview of what we're doing and where your funds would go. And you're really helping us put out high-quality material. You're helping us do things we've not been able to do before and enabling us to give more things away at high quality for free to more people. And we do it with your partnership. So take a look at the video there. It's only 2 minutes long. And then stand with us. Your gift of any size really goes a long way. Okay. I finished radio yesterday. I had to do another interview. I was driving in my car when I got an email about the terrorist attack in New York City. Nancy said something to me very striking last night. She said, the coverage of this is a fraction of, say, what happened with the shooting in Las Vegas. I understand that the number of casualties was much, 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 much greater in Las Vegas. But the fact is, we are getting so used to these things. We are getting so used to the latest terrorist attack or the latest Islamic terror attack, radical Islamic car attack and vehicle attack. And it's just almost becoming commonplace. And, oh, well, only 8 people killed and 15 or 17 injured, as opposed to being overwhelmingly shocking. And yes, this does remind us, this was not someone who was radicalized while in the States. I was talking to German Christians who work full-time with refugees in Germany, and they say that many of them get radicalized once they're in Germany, and they realize it's not just they're going to have automatic jobs or automatic state benefits and this and that, and then it, you know, it's not as easy as they're expecting it to be, and then you get the radical voices saying, yeah, see, the West, the system, you know, bad guys, and they recruit them. But in this case, the suspect from Uzbekistan had been interviewed, 2 years ago by federal authorities for potential connections with terrorism and got in on a particular type of visa that the Trump administration has wanted to be more strict with, a diversity visa. So always we want to be able to help legitimate refugees who are coming to our country, looking to our country to start a new life, to get away from extreme persecution and suffering. And legitimately, they want to become part of our country, and it's a dream for them to be here. We want to do our best to keep our doors open to such people. At the same time, whatever we can do to improve our vetting, we need to do it. Lives really are at stake. And you say, yeah, well, how many people die of terrorist attacks in America compared to car wrecks? Or how many die of terrorist attacks compared to obesity? Or I understand, but nobody gets in a car with the intent of killing you unless they are a terrorist, okay, unless they are bent on destruction. So, yeah, we do our best to prevent fatalities every way we can, but when we know someone is coming with the specific plan of trying to kill you, we do our best to stop that. So let us improve our vetting however we can. Let us tighten our borders in any way we can, while at the same time keeping our doors open to legitimate refugees in need. It's a challenging thing. The church has to work together with the government. And may God have mercy on the victims, their families, and he bring life out of death. Back with you tomorrow.